The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Tuesday evening California time space show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much for tuning in. Welcome back from your holiday weekend. I hope everybody had a great holiday weekend, a 3-day weekend, and you're ready to get back to doing the business of space. And we're certainly going to do that tonight with our guest, Frank White. But first, a couple of quick announcements. We're using the 60-minute format tonight. So please pay attention to the clock, and if you have an email or a phone call to get in to Frank, don't wait until the last minute or don't think it's a 90-minute show, because the show will be over then by the time we hear from you, and we absolutely do want to hear from you. So remember, you can call us toll-free anytime, 1-866-687-7223. And you can email us at drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. Furthermore, you can post a comment on our blog, which is at the Space Show website, thespaceshow.com, all the way over to the far right for upcoming show menu. This is the first program listed. Open up that page, which is also our archive and blog page. Scroll to the bottom, which is where comments always are, and write your comment or your question for our guest. As soon as you send it or post it, I will get a copy of it and can bring it up on the program. Of course, we do prefer phone calls, so once again, 1-866-687-7223, and email for those of you wanting to stay with email, drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. While you're at our website, remember to check out our detailed website newsletter. It is center right. And it is current as of the first of the week. And as you're looking at what's going on this week, note a couple of things. There is no Hotel Mars program this week. I have not heard from John Batchelor due to his illness recovery. So I'm not sure when we will be resuming Hotel Mars, but I'll keep you posted on that. And then also, we have a special show with Matt Billy tomorrow evening, making up for the one we should have had last Tuesday when the computer conked out and we couldn't stream the show. So we do have a 7 p.m. program tomorrow night, and then we're on the 60-minute format tonight. And the rest of the week is all there on the newsletters, and we hope you will participate with us going into the Sunday show. And they're pretty interesting, but read about them on the website. And you can follow us on all sorts of different social media. I don't usually talk about that, but we are on Twitter and Facebook and LinkedIn, and we've got links on our website for all of that material. Don't forget, in the upper left menu, there's a store. And if you're interested in Space Show logo wear, under support, you will see our Cafe Press store. Then there's Listen Live in that upper left menu. So that tells you how to listen to live programs, archive programs on the website, podcast, and Alexa by Amazon. If you have any questions on any of that, don't hesitate to email me, drspace@thespaceshow.com. Most important part of our homepage is, of course, the fact that we are listener-supported, and we're a nonprofit 501c3, and your support keeps us on the air, and we do absolutely appreciate your financial support. Remember, if you're a U.S. federal taxpayer, you do get a tax deduction because we are a 501c3 nonprofit. The same is true if you're a California taxpayer. We are a public benefit corporation in California. Our nonprofit parent is one, O-N-E, GiantLeapFoundation.org. check us out. And if you're interested in being on the advisory board, email me and I'll give you some information about that. And hopefully you'll have an interest in doing that. We do also have sponsors, so since this is 60 Minutes, let me just thank our sponsors, which include Northrop Grumman, the Space Foundation, Moonwards, AIAA, the Space Development Organization, Celestis, AIAA, and the National Space Society. So we would not be doing this program without our great sponsors, so we're very appreciative of them. So as I said a few minutes ago, Frank White is our guest, and he is a returning guest. He's been on since way, way back at the beginning of the space show when I first read the overview effect as I was writing my doctoral dissertation, going back many, many years. And he has a new book that we're going to be talking about, along with the evolution of the overview effect, because it does continue to evolve. His new book, which is already out in e-formatted book like Kindle, but it does come out on March 12th in paperback, is titled The COSMA, COSMA, Hypothesis, Implications of the Overview Effect. And for those of you who don't know Frank and have not listened to his show, very briefly, he is the author or co-author of 14 books on topics ranging from space exploration to climate change. He is magna cum laude graduate of Harvard, a member of Phi Beta Kappa, and a Rhodes Scholar. He has a Master of Philosophies in Politics from Oxford, and he worked for Harvard University for 17 years and now teaches at the Harvard Extension School and Harvard Summer School. His book, The Overview Effect, Space Exploration and Human Evolution, was first published in 1987. Wow, a long time ago. And it's now in its third edition and is considered by many to be a seminal work in the field of space exploration and development. And I am one of those who considers that for sure. Frank, welcome back to the Space Show. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you, David. It's good to be back.
What does the word COSMA actually mean?
Well, COSMA is a term that I developed for the universe. In writing about the astronaut relationship to the universe and the human relationship to the universe, I honestly wanted to personalize it a little bit. And rather than cosmos or universe, I settled on the feminine and called it COSMA. So it's a term that I use alternatively with universe, and it's a term that just came to me. I can't say that it was something that I gave a lot of thought to. It was something that just seemed right in developing a new way of thinking about our relationship with the universe.
So it's not a word we would find in the dictionary, probably.
You may not. That's a really good question. I didn't find it in the dictionary, but if the book is successful, maybe it'll get in the dictionary. That would be great.
Well, that's something we can keep checking on. as you know, is it gaining enough momentum to be a dictionary word? And I have no idea what the requirements are to be a dictionary word, but there probably are some kind of requirements for that. Who knows? So implications of the overview effect. And the back cover talks about the fact that spaceflight should really be a lot more or transcending how we focus on space benefiting humanity, which we all talk about all the time. You suggest that we should also ask how to create a symbiotic relationship with the universe, giving back as much as we take and spreading life intelligence and self-awareness throughout the solar system and beyond, otherwise creating a philosophy of space exploration and settlement rather than just being satisfied with doing space exploration and settlement. Do I kind of have that right?
Yeah, there's a lot to that short paragraph that you quoted, and if you like, I could go back to the origins of that line of thought.
Sure, yes, of course.
Yeah. Well, it started with the overview effect, and I do want to say the Cosmo hypothesis is definitely either a descendant of the overview effect or a sibling. I'm not quite sure which. But the ideas that are in this book originated when I was writing the overview effect. And in particular, there was a moment when I was working on the overview effect in the wake of the Challenger disaster, when they had a TV show this week with David Brinkley, and George Will said to Tom Wolfe, author of The Right Stuff, "It seems that we are using rather banal reasons for exploring space, aren't we? Like nonstick frying pans." And Tom Wolfe said, "You're absolutely right. This country has never had a philosophy of space exploration." That hit me like a ton of bricks, and I started working on integrating a space philosophy into the writing of the overview effect. And as often happens when I'm writing, and I'm sure it's true of others, I realized somewhere along the way that all of our reasons for space exploration were, from our point of view, what humanity could get out of it. And I asked myself, well, what about the environment we're moving into, the universe? What are we doing that benefits the environment? And what is the purpose of space exploration from Cosmo's point of view? And that is discussed in some detail in the overview effect, but I pursued it further in the Cosmo hypothesis. And the hypothesis that I laid out is that the universe is alive, intelligent, and self-aware because we are in the universe. We're part of it. And it seemed to me perhaps our function, our purpose, is to expand the domain of life, self-awareness, and intelligence to larger and larger portions of the universe. And that struck me as at least a starting point for conversation, because the question that kept coming up, David, was, we humans are the products of billions of years of evolution, and here we are about to become a spacefaring species. What is it in the evolutionary process that has supported us to get to this point? What function or what purpose are we serving from that point of view? And that's the answer I have come up with in the book. But I do want to say the most important thing is to raise the question. I want to hear from other people as to what they think. And then the other point I would make, and we can go into this in more detail, is that this is not an abstract philosophy. It's a philosophy that hopefully will inform how we go about space exploration from here. And there's a whole section on that, which is a practical space program that I think is a little different from what we're doing today.
So if this were a typical commercial space, new space type of program with, I'm going to get in trouble for this, but for general discussion purposes with the usual type of space entrepreneurs, successful businessmen and women running different kinds of space companies, why we're doing this, I mean, a lot of them might say, you know, to make money, to develop a space economy, to create new opportunities, to improve humanity. But I'm thinking that's not really what you're talking about. And I think you're looking way beyond that as a purpose. Those might be some benefits and results along the way, but I'm guessing, Frank, that that's not what you think is a core purpose of why so many of us are involved in doing this in different ways for each of us, because we all bring to the table different characteristics, capabilities, perspectives, understandings, ideologies, and space is big enough to accommodate us all.
Yeah, right. I'm not negating commercial space exploration either. I would agree with you that the rationales we give for doing it are not complete. They're not wrong. I mean, yes, commercial space will make money for people. It will create wealth. It, I believe, will improve life on Earth, and I believe it also will power or provide the impetus for exploration and development. So I don't think we can fulfill the larger purpose without fulfilling these sub-purposes. And the same thing happened in other ages of exploration. I mean, the explorers, you know, they had to give the sovereigns, the kings, the queens, and the various powers that be, they had to give them a reason that was pretty practical and quote-unquote down to earth. But I think those explorers kind of had an idea there was something more to what they were doing than that. And so I think the same holds here. Those reasons, those purposes are not to be negated. And in fact, I recently gave a talk at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study at Harvard. We had a gathering there on space resources. And we were talking about space resources and the overview effect. And, you know, what is the connection between exploiting space resources and the overview effect? And what I concluded was that as we move out into the solar system, just as what has happened in orbit and on the moon, our awareness of ourselves has been transformed. And as we move further out into the solar system and beyond, our awareness will continue to be transformed, and we probably will not do it unless we also have some kind of use of space resources to do it. So, again, it's not an end in itself, but it supports a larger outcome.
Do people engaged in space development, resource development, in situ resource development, all of this, do they need to have the bigger vision that I'm 100% sure you're talking about, and that is in the book, and in fact it's in all of your books, or is making money or finding resources that we can use here on Earth or in space, is that sufficient to carry on that part of the development phase?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I think that it's going to be important if we want to do space exploration right to have a balance between exploration and exploitation. I'm hoping that those who are primarily going to be thinking exploitation will also understand this larger purpose. For example, one of the points I've been making lately is that we had a remarkable event recently in which Columbus, Ohio, which was named for Christopher Columbus, did not have Columbus Day. They had Indigenous Peoples Day. And we see cities and towns around the country making that same move. And we ask our question, you know, why did that happen? What was the reason for it? And the reason was that we have gone from merely seeing Columbus as a great explorer to realizing that he also was a great exploiter. And that's 500 years down the road. One of the issues that I consider a lot, and one of the reasons I wanted to develop the Human Space Program, which is the practical outcome of the theory, 500 years from now, I wonder if Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos and Richard Branson will be seen by our descendants as heroes or villains. And to make it more personal, I've asked myself, how will I be viewed? How will David Livingston be viewed? How will all of the space advocates be viewed? And so I think the answer is we have to balance exploration and exploitation of the space environment in a good way. And this may seem awfully idealistic. I'm kind of laughing at how idealistic it sounds, but we have had this shift in awareness on the Earth, largely because of seeing the Earth from a distance, the overview effect. We have gone from a pretty focused approach to the Earth, which has been use it up, you know, make use of it, to an idea of, well, you know, maybe we have to think about a more balanced approach. So I'm thinking maybe we can take that awareness out into the solar system, and even those folks who are mostly focused on the entrepreneurial aspects can have that broader picture, and it can inform how they go about it.
I think, you know, part of the challenge in that broader picture is that it is still really challenging, difficult, and expensive, and a million other adjectives to do anything in space. Whereas, you know, we've evolved on Earth that we can do so much. We can transport, we can move, we can, you know, we can fly to Australia in, what, 10 hours or something like that. And almost anyone, you know, in the Western world at least, can probably do that. You know, we have instant 24/7 communications from around the world, and I have this earthquake app on my iPhone, and I'll get earthquake alerts, and it'll give me earthquakes in China and South America and Asia, and it'll say 4 minutes ago. So, you know, I don't even think the people, you know, living in these countries get the reports as fast as I get them on my iPhone. So Earth is, I don't want to say it's mastered, because there sure is a hell of a lot of room for improvement on Earth. God, every day I talk about that with friends of mine. But space, we're not even at the point of thinking anything's mastered. So to have the broad vision, it's almost like we're not, we haven't gone through enough of the development phases to get to the broader thinking yet, except for a few of us, or you, for example.
It's a good point, and I think
it's coming.
Yeah.
But I think figuring out the nuts and bolts of how to do it and make that accessible is probably you know, the challenge of the day.
Well, you know, I've been working with a lot of commercial space entrepreneurs, working on their communications planning through the Broder Space Group here in Boston. And I agree. Some of the people I talked to have said to me, I was inspired to get into the space business by your book, The Overview Effect. And that's very meaningful to me. But on a day-to-day basis, their main goal is to get funding and proof of concept. And, you know, they're really forced to look at the very practical, everyday effort of space business. So I understand that. And I don't really expect a transformation overnight through the work that I'm doing, but I do think it's work that needs to be done. And I feel like we are already out there. I mean, the whole issue of space debris is a pretty good example of trying to get a foothold off the planet and not thinking too far ahead about the implications of what we're doing and how we're doing it. And so now it's a problem we have to solve. I've raised this question before, and I've given talks on this kind of issue, and I said, how many of you think we should be using nuclear power on Mars? And everybody says, no, we shouldn't do that, you know. We haven't even solved the problem of nuclear waste on Earth. And we know that the Curiosity rover is powered by nuclear fuel. I mean, we're already actually doing that, and people are not aware that we're doing it. I'm not taking a stand against using it. I'm just saying it wasn't really discussed. It hasn't really been discussed. So I hear what you're saying, but I also do see an awareness now of people raising questions about how we go about these ventures in the solar system. And I'm very focused on the solar system, although we talk about space and we talk about the universe. It really is the solar system where our next step is going to be taken.
I have an email from you, from Jack. And listeners, we'd love to hear from you and hear some of your ideas on what we're talking about. And our phone number is 1-866-687-7223. And remember, we're on the shorter format tonight. And Jack says, I think part of the problem with what the two of you may be talking about is that most people, when these topics come up, they're in an umbrella that is loosely constructed under the ethics of space development or space tourism or space flight or space travel. And then that gets to be subjective, and sometimes it gets to have a heavy hand on are you ethical or not ethical. I noticed that in your discussion, neither of you have mentioned ethics once, and neither of you have put forth any judgment. I think ethics puts forth a lot of judgment. Are you ethical or are you unethical? So I think the way the problem is phrased for most people is through this ethical aspect or ethical window, and I don't think that's very constructive given what I'm hearing from you, Frank, tonight.
David, do you understand what part of it is not constructive? I'm not sure I understand.
No, he thinks you're constructive. Jack, correct me with another email if I'm wrong. Jack believes what you're talking about is constructive.
Mm-hmm.
When people come on that are talking about ethics in space, and is it ethical to settle Mars, or is it ethical for space tourism, the ethical overlay is often judgmental.
I get it.
And
yeah.
People are either sort of characterized by their behavior as being ethical or non-ethical. But what I'm hearing Jack say is that you and I are not talking about judgment on anyone or ethical behavior or not ethical behavior, but about a broader vision for, you know, how to make space sort of, I guess in my words, not your words, work and be more than just, you know, sort of the Kool-Aid statement that we're going to go out and save humanity,
yeah.
You know, which we all hear,
yeah.
You know, probably too often.
Yeah.
But we haven't talked about ethics at all, but a lot of times I think people doing ethical discussions in space touch on what we're talking about. But as soon as you do it from an ethical perspective, I agree with Jack, by the way. I think you get into judgment and all sorts of other things that are not included in what you're talking about.
Mm. Well, I appreciate that comment, Jack, and I appreciate your clarification of it, David. I don't really exclude ethics from the conversation, and in fact, in the conceptualization of the human space program that I've developed with my colleague, Ted Field, we're envisioning 16 task forces that will come together and discuss the major issues that should be looked at in exploring and developing the solar system. And I think we do have a task force on ethics that would get into that, because I think you do have to tackle that issue, and it's there, and people will bring it up. But I agree that what you and I are talking about, David, is even larger than the ethical perspective. And the main thing Jack is saying that I totally agree with is I am trying to avoid judgment here. And I'm trying to develop a philosophy of space exploration that is based on some understanding of who we as a species are and where we're going and what we can add to this incredible universe that we're part of, and how we can not improve it. It's not really to be improved, but how we can again give as much as we take from it.
You have a caller on hold.
Okay.
Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you? Thank you very much for calling.
This is Marshall in snowy Renfro, Oklahoma.
Okay, Okie. What's on your mind?
I remember in my history classes something about Stalin basically proceeded to rewrite the history of Russia to meet his political ambitions. And there's always been the statement, he who wins the war writes the history. Gee, in 200 or 300 years, it's going to be who is in political power that's really going to decide who's a hero and who's a dip. What's your take on that?
I think you're absolutely right. I think that's a really good point. And in that sense, we can't control how the history is written about us. However, I do find it refreshing for me personally. I don't know if other people feel this way, but I do find it refreshing to see that we look back on our history and we change how we see it based on our current awareness. And so if I can do anything to ensure that our generation is looked upon in a positive way, I would really, really like to do that. And so that really motivates me. I mean, it's interesting. People are always talking about what motivates you to go into outer space and what motivates you to want to be involved in space. And what motivates me most, and this is a change for me, incidentally, what motivates me most is to want to do it right, to want to do it in a positive way. And that is a change because my initial interest in space as an advocate was, let's just get out there. That's what's important. We can't stay on this planet forever. And it's really going to be an amazing adventure to get off the planet. And that was an advocacy position. And I'm sure, David, you understand what I'm talking about. I'm sure you've been there. I'm sure everybody listening has been there and may still be there. But what I want to do now more than advocate is start a conversation and leave no stone unturned in terms of trying to do the best we can that whoever writes that history sees us in a positive light.
Yeah. In other words, make sure they got lots of footnotes, right?
Yeah. That's a good way to put it.
But the other thing is I notice that in history there's a lot of people. I'm thinking of, I think it was Eric the Red that basically named Greenland instead of Iceland, too, because it's part of the sales pitch, right? And that's another thing I have problems with, is there's prophets out there that basically comes in there and, sells a lot of snake oil, and then it actually works, and everybody goes, hey, amazing, and that person's a hero, even though he was actually an idiot. There's where I get problems, too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think what I would say about that is you're saying that perception creates reality.
Yeah.
Right.
And it may be somebody who's slightly off the loose end, like Elon, who actually makes things work. Wow, isn't that fun?
Yeah. Well, you've got an interesting perspective, and I hope you'll keep thinking about it, not settle on one point of view, because that's another thing that I want to make is that I don't see myself personally coming up with the answer to all the big questions. If there's anything this book should do, and I hope it will do, it will at least trigger and cause some sort of dialogue that isn't taking place right now. It's a kind of thing that we really need a lot of people talking about and thinking about to get the best ideas out there.
So are you creating a blog for the book for people to have these discussions with you?
That's a good idea. I probably will. I haven't done it yet. I do have my own blog. I'm blogging pretty constantly.
Give us the address for your own blog.
Yeah, it's... hang on, let me just look it up so I'll give you the right one.
Or you can email it to me and I'll put it in the...
Yeah, let me email it to you. It's
okay, email it to me by the morning so that I can post it when I archive the show.
Sure. Yeah, so I'm using that. I'm also creating two different websites. One will be for me as an author, but the other is going to be a website for the Human Space Program, which is discussed in a lot of detail in the book.
But, if you had a specific blog for this specific conversation from this specific book, you might be surprised by some of what all of us learn from it.
Yeah, well, we might well do that. That's a great idea, and it's pretty easy to create a blog these days, so there's really no reason not to. But I'll send you the link to the one I have now, and we can certainly start chatting about it now.
Yeah, the only thing that's not easy is supervising and monitoring it so that, there's no trash and garbage and filth.
Yeah, right.
Because you never know these days what you may get.
Yeah.
But I think that'd be great. Marshall, are you still with us?
Yeah, I'm still here. It seems like I actually produced a wonderfully good idea here. Isn't that
you
amazing
did.
Of me? Anyway, let's see. I don't really have any good thoughts at the moment. If I think of something, I'll try to call back.
Thank you for your call, Marshall. Always
Thanks,
good
Marshall.
To hear from you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So, listeners, Marshall has vacated the line, and it is available. And there is still time if you would like to call us tonight. And we would like to hear from you and what you think about all of this. 1-866-687-7223. And email remains drspace@thespaceshow.com. You keep talking about the Human Space Program. So that is a big part of your book. So let's talk about that for a minute. How do you define the Human Space Program? Because I've read it, it's part two of the book. It's probably not exactly what everybody else thinks about when someone mentions the Human Space Program.
Yeah, probably is different. The origin of that idea is back in the overview effect when I was realizing what astronauts were telling me about what they saw from orbit and the moon. And as I concluded the book, I thought, the exploration of the universe is not a national project. It's a global project. It should be all of us together. And in the overview effect, I sketched out the Human Space Program with as a central project for all of humanity lasting through the millennium, and I just sketched out some of the things I thought we should do. And now, in the Cosmo Hypothesis, it's evolved, and I gave a talk about all of this at my reunion at Harvard, and one of my classmates came up to me and said, I'd like to help you on this, and we have worked together to create this plan. And what it looks like at this point is we would like to create these task forces on government, economics, ethics, environment, all the different issues as we move out into the solar system, and then have those task forces report in, and we would create a plan, not a report, but a plan for what we call the comprehensive and inclusive and sustainable development of the solar system. So we're going to ask each task force to really come up with some recommendations that will be incorporated into the plan. The other two elements that are worth mentioning is that we're going to run simulations against the plan. So we're going to come up with potential activities or scenarios that might test certain aspects of the plan and see how resilient it is. And then the final step is really to share it widely with the public and with the key players. So once we have it in place, we'd like to take it to Elon Musk and say, hey, do you want to sign on to the basic principles here? Jeff Bezos, Richard Branson, NASA, the Chinese space program, and find out if people are willing to essentially support what we've come up with. And if we can do that, we will have something like the integrated space plan that people have been working on, something like the roadmap that the, 14 different space agencies have been working on, but it won't just be a technical approach to how to do it. It's going to be also an approach that considers questions like the ones we've raised. For example, should we be using nuclear power? And questions of inequity, questions of who gets to participate in this. So that is the Human Space Program. It's an exercise in developing a project that all of humanity can get involved in and can have an opinion about. And again, I'm not as concerned with whether Blue Origin buys into the plan or not. What I'm interested in is starting a conversation about how we go about this. And it really goes back to the hypothesis that it should be a balance of exploration and exploitation, and it should have some sense of our contribution to the larger whole.
You have an email from Cindy, who is in Seattle, and she said, it would seem to me that it might be better rather than taking a finished product or a bunch of recommendations to people like Musk and Bezos and others, but to incorporate them, if they're willing to be incorporated, into the development of the 16 task forces. I would say the same for national space agencies like NASA and ESA and others around the world, and have them be part of all of this rather than looking over a somewhat finished document. Any thoughts on that?
I think that's absolutely right. I didn't mean to imply that we wouldn't want that. And I mean, in fact, I would think that some of the organizations I've mentioned might provide funding for this, because I think it would be in their interest to participate both financially and intellectually. Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that. We'd love as much participation as possible. In fact, I'll hold a chair for Jeff on one of the task forces if he wants to be there. But seriously, Cindy's exactly right, and you're right too. The more involvement we could get from these sectors as we work on this, the better. However, once the whole thing is together, I do think some sort of formal blessing or refusal to bless would be important too. And, let's just say that that SpaceX is involved, and they're very involved in the process. And then at the end, the outcome isn't really something they consider that they want to support. They may decide, even though they've been engaged in the process, it didn't produce something they're comfortable with. And that they should have the option of saying, well, you know, nice work, but we're not on board.
Have you done any outreach to NASA or to SpaceX or any of these organizations, ESA, yet, or is that forthcoming?
Well, no formal outreach. I mean, I've had informal conversations with people at NASA. I've had informal conversations with people at some of the private space companies, and they know this is happening, but I haven't made a formal outreach yet. We've been waiting to some extent for the book to come out, because that in some ways is really the launch of the project.
And that's coming up in March.
Yeah, March 12th. I did want to mention that in addition to Kindle, the book is also available on Audible. And I think some people find that an easier way to get information than reading.
Are you reading the book for the Audible?
No. It's being read by quite a talented narrator, Larry Tobias.
Okay.
I think you'll like his voice.
I like British women's voices, but then that's...
Well, I don't have that for you.
that's another story. Are you planning any event? You mentioned launch. So on March 10th, are you planning a launch ceremony, for example?
We don't have anything planned quite yet. I don't know if there will actually be a formal launch event, but that is the day that it will be available and people can order it and get it. I mean, people can order it now and pre-order it. So it will start shipping on the 12th.
March 10th is also when daylight savings time returns. So is there anything significant or ominous
No.
about that?
No, nothing there.
You're sure about that, huh?
I'm pretty sure of it, yeah. You know, there is one other element to this book I wanted to mention, David, that we haven't touched on. When I was writing the overview effect, of course, the heart and soul of that book is interviews with astronauts. And, again, I'm always grateful to the astronauts who've helped me with this work. But I was extremely focused on their perceptions of the Earth from orbit or the moon, and that was a lot of the focus of the book. Part of what's a little different about the new book is that I went through all the existing interviews, and wherever the astronauts talked about their shift in perception of the universe, I've put it into this book. And one of the most interesting quotes comes from Al Sacco Jr., who flew on the shuttle, and who said that people ask him why would he risk his life to go into outer space, and he said, "I tell them about the astronaut secret. All of the astronauts know this secret, which is we are not only citizens of this planet, we are citizens of the universe." And that, in a way, summarizes what this book is all about. It's about the question of what does it mean for humanity to be citizens not only of the planet, but of the universe. It's kind of an open-ended question, but it lies behind the book and the project and everything we're talking about. And I pose it as a question. And I think part of what we're trying to do here is generate answers.
Well, tell me what tax rate the universe has and then I'll tell you. That may be where we all go next. I have heard that before, but not as the astronaut secret, because a lot of people that I speak to on the space show that are speaking more about visionary work rather than engineering or nozzle size or propulsion or a specific planetary mission, for example, like New Horizons, they see themselves and their work as being part of the solar system, part of the universe. They don't see it as being, you know, more locally isolated
right.
to Texas or California or the United States or Europe or whatever. So they have thought of themselves in a much broader way. And so I think people that look outward, you know, for reasons, for understanding, do see themselves, you know, in a bigger way. And, you know, I told you before the show started that, you know, I used to go out and with a Cub Scout telescope, you know, as a little kid and look in the sky. And I always kind of felt that the overview effect was like bringing the Earth into space and all of the beyond rather than just focusing on the Earth. So I've always thought of being part, I didn't think in terms of citizenship, but in being part of what's out there. And of course, the Earth is included in what's out there. So many of us have thought of that, but don't see it as a secret. But I think the people I talk to that are more vision oriented seem to express that more openly than others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And maybe engineers don't think like that; they think differently, or physicists, or something. I don't know. But
right.
I don't think it says. It's only related to astronauts. I think a lot of people believe that.
I think you're right. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, and I think that's encouraging. In terms of what I'm writing about here, is that there are people with this awareness on this planet, and I suppose the point of writing a book or doing a documentary or however we communicate it, doing the space show, is to try to spread that awareness so that it becomes more generalized. I think doing that is good for the Earth and good for the people of the Earth, and I think it will be good for the next phase of the adventure, which is moving out into the solar system, which, incidentally, I'm very excited about it. I mean, you know, I think it's an amazing next step for us, and we're lucky to be alive when it's happening.
I have another email from you, kind of interesting. Sharon is in Tucson, and she says, Frank, you've been on the space show for years, and as David said, you've written around 14 books, and I'm sure you and your wife have friends that are not part of the space community, that you have work associates that are not part of the space community. Can you estimate how many people outside the space community that you have come in contact with, either through work or friendship or social engagements, that you have influenced into becoming part of the space community or seeing space as an integral part of their life as you do? I'm wondering if you've gone viral.
You know, that's a really fascinating question, and I can't answer it. I mean, I did at one point try to estimate how many people might have heard about the overview effect or read the book, and I think I came up with a number like 25,000 or something like that. But the best information we have for viral impact is really the film Overview, which has now been seen by 8 million people. I can't say how many of those people were, I can't say how many of those people were not in the space community beforehand. So I don't know. I don't know how to parse that, but that's a pretty good number. and it's had a lot of impact. There's no question about that.
What about in your personal sphere? Because she made her question personal to you and your social life, your career. I'm sure not everybody is a space cadet that you know or hang with. So.
Yeah, it's probably in the hundreds, really, that I could verify. And I think one of the reasons that I've had the impact is not so much the cogency of my argument, but my persistence. You know, my friends, my family, people who know me know that I'm a pretty serious person. And I think what has gotten them interested in space is the fact that I just have never given up on it. I keep talking about it, telling people it's important, sharing that. And I think it's more the persistence over time that has perhaps swayed them to agree and, you know, to take what we take seriously, for them to begin to think, well, I think there might be something to this.
If you... or if anyone could show how this line of thinking and being helps in living our lives today, I think, you know, that'd be a slam dunk. I think that's pretty hard to do.
Yeah.
But I think that being able to translate what we're talking about into a better life today, not for,
right,
you know, 200 years from now, or not for your grandchildren, you'd have a keeper. But maybe some people have ideas on how to do that. And I think that's really challenging, too, but probably worth taking on the challenge.
I do. I think so as well. And one of the lessons I've learned is that if you can show how this kind of work and this kind of thinking makes a difference to life on Earth, then people are universally interested, or almost everyone is interested. Just like you said, that speaks to everyone, even if they have no interest in human expansion into the solar system. People do care about the home planet. Maybe not enough, but they do care, and when it's brought home to them that this kind of work will change awareness, change behavior, make the Earth a better place to live, that does tend to get their attention.
I'm doing a show tomorrow with Matt Billy. Do you know him?
I don't.
With Booz Allen Hamilton. But they have a project for tracking whales using microsatellites.
Oh, yeah. And, there you go.
And so, I mean, that does make the Earth a better place today.
And using
space and technology to do that. So I'm looking forward to that discussion with Matt. But so people don't have to love space and want to go to Mars and want to do space settlement and look for ET everywhere and all of that to realize there's a value here in saving whales, for example, and probably other wildlife as well.
Absolutely. And we take for granted things like satellites, but that's part of the space environment that's only been around for a while, you know, 50 years now, 60 years. And just think of one simple thing that those satellites do for us, which is weather forecasting. I mean, if someone did a study of how many lives have been saved by weather forecasting improvement in the last 50 to 60 years, you'd have a metric right there for how technology in the space environment is improving life on Earth.
So, and I've done shows with people who run international rescue and relief services, even for countries, and they all are space-based. Am I losing you, Frank? I think I may have lost him. Frank, are you there? I may have lost him. But the rescue services are all relying on space, and they're saving hundreds, if not thousands, of lives every year. Listeners, I know he wanted to do an hour. That's an abrupt way to end the show. Stay put and I'll see
if you'd like to make a...
Stay put and I'll see if I can get him on for concluding comments. So,
David, sorry, my landline died.
How does a landline die?
Not enough charge.
Oh, so it was a cordless phone.
Yeah.
Shame on you. You can't go into space managing communications that way, Frankie.
I agree.
I kept trying to call you, and of course I couldn't get anything. So
yeah.
And I know you wanted
sorry.
To only do an hour, but I thought that'd be an abrupt way to end the program right on the top of the hour. So
yeah, I'm sorry about that. Are we off the air now?
No, all of this is on. We're on the air.
I wanted
to give you a chance to wind up and offer concluding comments, and if we left anything out that you wanted to talk about, to make sure you got them in.
Well, thank you for calling back. You know, one thing that I learned from talking to astronauts is you should always have a backup plan. So I'm glad we were able to at least summarize and finish up. But
that brings me to a very funny story, because I was doing an interview years and years ago at a Mars Society conference in UCLA. And, God, I can't remember the person from at NASA. He was the deputy administrator at the time. I want to say Scott something.
Uh-huh.
He's an engineer, and this was at the time where the vision for space exploration was just being developed. I mean, we're going way
mm-hmm.
back in time. And I had my microphone. We were sitting in a chair in a sort of a back room part of UCLA, and the tape recorder died.
Yeah.
I mean, just completely dead. And I lost 90% of the interview. And I was totally humiliated, felt very unprofessional. It wasn't an issue of changing batteries. It died. And
mm-hmm.
I had no backup, and I had to tell him the truth. And a girl next to a woman, I should say, to be correct today, was trying to listen in on the interview. And she before it ended and I said goodbye, she said, "I've heard what happened. Here is my little tape recorder that I've been using for recording guests. If you'll continue the interview," and I'm going to say Scott, but I don't remember if that's his name. I think it was Scott Horwitz. That's
okay.
We'll finish the interview. Use my recorder, and you can take it back to the hotel and transcribe it back to your computer, and I'll tell you how to reach me. So she handed me this little cassette, you know, micro tape recorder, and I did do the interview with what I had on my digital one, plus what she gave me, and we fixed it, but I was still totally embarrassed and felt unprofessional. And I went home, and I ordered a second backup in the field radio tape recorder interview, and I have now never done an interview without at least two tape recorder microphones running.
Yeah, there you go.
It only takes one time to get burned where you need a backup.
I know. Well said. Well said. Well,
anyway, have we forgotten anything? What else would you like to talk about?
No, I don't. I think we covered everything. I would like to just repeat what I said before, which is that I hope people will take the book not as a final statement, but part of an ongoing quest, really, that I think all of us are on. I mean, I know from talking with your listeners that we're all asking this question, what is the purpose of space exploration? Why do we want to do it? What are the benefits it will bring? And also, that last question that was asked, which is, how do we communicate it to people who do not inherently understand it or are not inherently excited about it? So I hope people will take the book in that way. I feel like I still have a lot more writing to do, a lot more questioning to do about this topic, and I would simply invite everyone to get involved in it and perhaps get involved in the Human Space Program And I will definitely look into starting a blog so that we can keep this conversation going.
Well, if you do so, we'll come back on the show and you can announce that, and we'll help you promote
sure.
it. So I look forward to that.
Great. Well, thanks for the opportunity tonight, David. Your questions are always great. Your audience is always great. And I'll be on the space show as often as you invite me.
Okay.
So
well,
again.
When you're ready to come back or with some new ideas or when you see how things are going, let me know. And you're always welcome and we look forward to it.
Okay, and I'll have a better phone.
Okay, listeners, thank you for Marshall calling in and those of you who sent emails. And, Frank, I'll have this archived in the morning and send it off to you so you'll know where it is. And if you want to use it or quote from it or access it, that's fine. And
okay.
We will look forward to that. And one more thing, listeners, our sponsor is also the Space Plan, which Frank mentioned a few minutes ago. The Integrated Space Plan is a great sponsor. And we didn't mention them up front, my omission, but I do want to make sure I thank them for being a great sponsor, and they are very important to the Space Show program. Everybody have a great night, and good night from Frank and David and the Space Show.